Hey, Rob Bradford here. You guys know I'm always up for a good MVP story, and one of the best stories is Wasabi Technology. Wasabi is the world's hottest cloud storage company, and it's become the go-to provider for professional and collegiate sports teams, including 20 Major League Baseball teams like the Red Sox and NHL teams like the Bruins and Vancouver Canucks. Even the Liverpool Football Club is getting in on the Wasabi action. So why is Wasabi the MVP? Well, Wasabi was purpose-built to free businesses from skyrocketing storage costs and unpredictable transaction fees that the Amazons of the world are charging. In fact, Wasabi is up to 80% less than those hyperscalers and doesn't charge a cent for businesses to access their data. From Wasabi's AI-enabled intelligent media storage, Wasabi Air, to the industry's only cloud storage service with triple protection against cyber criminals, data deletion, and ransomware, Wasabi's taking the lead in driving innovation in data storage and helping sports teams to unleash the power of their data. Wasabi, another Boston-based championship team.
In a very fitting 2020 way, this week should have been the end of the minor league baseball regular season. I am sitting in a state that half the state has been under wildfire advisories and the other half under snow and freeze advisories, a winter storm watch. I got snow at my house yesterday on September 8th, and there's no minor league baseball to talk about this week. It all plays in perfectly. It's 2020, man. It's isn't it great for everybody? Aren't you?
Yeah, right? I mean, we'll talk about this more later, but in this sort of what if land, imagine if, let's say, the Rocky Mountain Vibes had made the Pioneer League postseason.
Yeah.
We have a snow delay in the playoffs.
Labor Day weekend, essentially.
Yeah.
No, it's great. It's very normal. Everything's very normal and cool.
Or I guess anywhere in the Pioneer League, really, right? Isn't it snowing?
Yeah, pretty much.
Just all over the Rocky Mountains?
Yeah. It's been a very regular early September, obviously. And it's supposed to be back to like 89 degrees by next week. Everything's real normal.
Do you think the snow will stick or no?
We didn't even really get that much. We were supposed to get 3 to 6 inches of snow, and we got like a dusting. Like, it barely stuck to the grass. I mean, it's been a billion degrees. It was 94 degrees 2 days ago and then dropped 50 some degrees that night. Like, it's, you know, it's summertime still. The ground is too warm. There wasn't going to be much that stuck. But yeah, so I think, you know, the playoffs would have been able to go on rather quickly, but man, it would have been a miserable game if anybody had to play last night, but they didn't, because 2020. It's all great.
Yeah.
So we're kicking you off on an upbeat note on this week's episode of the show. Before the show, from MILB.com, the official podcast of minor league baseball, my name is Tyler Mon. Sam Dykstra is in New York City, and we got a lot to get to on this week's episode of the show. And we will start with some news from our world, the world of minor league baseball, in a release that was sent out yesterday. We're recording this on the 9th of September, and this, the headline from St. Petersburg, Florida: after 38 years of professional baseball and 28 years with the minor league baseball office, minor league baseball president and CEO Pat O'Connor today announced that he will retire on December 31st, 2020. Pat O'Connor has been with minor league baseball since 1993. He was the chief operating officer then, and was named vice president of administration following the 95 season. He was named the 11th president in minor league baseball history in December of 2007, and was actually just reelected to that post in 2019. But obviously there is a new chapter coming in the relationship between Major League Baseball and minor league baseball, as we are all very aware. And Pat O'Connor announcing his retirement after 38 years in professional baseball. Sam, your thoughts on this news, which broke yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, this is what it comes down to at its very base level, is just, this is a changing time for minor league baseball. You know, we've all known that. If anybody's following the news lately, you know that the PBA is up this fall. There's been a lot of negotiations, both through the media and behind closed doors, where we don't know what's happening. We don't know everything that's coming out, and we don't know what it's going to look like here on the other side. But Pat O'Connor, you know, not stepping down, but he's announced his retirement, like Tyler said, and, you know, stepping away from the MILB side at the end of this year on December 31st, is just another piece of that. It's another sign that things are going to be very different whenever we get to the 2021 season. you look at Pat O'Connor's tenure and what he's done for minor league baseball and how much bigger it is in the sports landscape now than it was when he started. I'm not going to put that entirely on him. I think the industry has driven a lot itself, and I think fan interest has drummed up a lot. But just looking at one man's career and seeing what minor league baseball was at the beginning, which was kind of a niche thing, and where it is now, in which this show exists, for example. And again, I'm not giving Pat O'Connor for this show, but the fact that there's enough interest in minor league baseball for you guys to tune in every week and still check in on what the goings on of MLB are, says something about the state of our sport and the state of this industry specifically. One interesting note to me that you all can look into however you want is that part of the announcement wasn't that there's a natural successor involved right yet. Let's see what minor league baseball is going to look like. There's been some talk about MLB taking over operations of minor league baseball, but would there be somebody under that MLB umbrella who would essentially be a minor league commissioner? We don't know that yet. They might not even know that yet as they hammer things out. Would Rob Manfred kind of take over that as well? We'll see how that goes. And obviously lots of benefits and lots of downsides to potential changes in minor league baseball. But Pat O'Connor leaving is kind of an end of its own era. We're going to talk to Ben about this briefly, but he tweeted that out yesterday and we were talking to him about it off mic. Just saying end of an era encapsulates so much about this. It's the end of the Pat O'Connor era in minor league baseball. And it's the end of an era in minor league baseball itself in some ways. And we'll wait for the details and break it all down when we know exactly what it's going to look like on the other side. But one other shoe to drop here is this Pat O'Connor news.
Yeah, and obviously, there is so much going on in the world of minor league baseball and will be going on as the professional baseball agreement expires on September 30th, which is the governing agreement between Major League Baseball and minor league baseball. We would love to discuss what we know, but there is so much that we don't know. And I think that's, just kind of in a circumstance like this where there are negotiations and there are things that are going on. A lot of that happens behind the scenes. And so we don't know a lot of the mechanics moving behind the closed doors of those negotiations right now. So it's not that we are keeping you shut out. We are eagerly awaiting that news, as are a lot of people. And it is the end of an era, but it's, to be honest, and I'll just say this from stuff that I have read, I think there are a lot of potentially really exciting elements that are coming or could potentially be coming down the track for 2021 and beyond. But we'll await the official news on all those things. So it's kind of tough because 2020 has been a year that has just been fraught with uncertainty in everything in life. And so this is another thing that we, don't have right now a lot of definitive information on, but that's kind of the way we've all existed in 2020 in every facet of our daily existence. So we obviously will be with you here throughout all of the developments over the next few weeks and into the baseball offseason and beyond. And but that is the biggest news from MILB as of this week. This week would have been the start of the minor league baseball postseason. And instead, it's an exciting time for prospects in a lot of places who have been promoted and have made their major league debuts. I think there have been like 177 players to make their big league debuts so far this year. But Sam, this is ordinarily such an exciting week for us because we dive into the minor league playoffs. We don't have that this year, which is a bummer.
Yeah, Monday, I tweeted about this, over the weekend. Monday was supposed to be the official end of the minor league season for so many teams. Labor Day was on Monday. Teams like to go out with a bang, have everybody get to the park on that last day of the season. We don't get that this year. There are so many ways that is a celebration, not only for us as a site, but just across the sport. Ben wrote this story last week about guys who play all nine positions in a game. That's the thing we always look for in the last week. Sometimes there's fun pitching matchups. Sometimes there's things like every player in the lineup uses the same bat. Just those little quirks that when you have so much baseball going on and for it all to stop on one day like that. And there are some things I talked before about the Pioneer League postseason happening right now. I think I got that a little bit wrong. I think the Pioneer League regular season extends beyond Monday. But anyway, when there's just so much about minor league baseball that just stops on one day, and we've had that basically every day since the minor league season was canceled, it's impossible not to miss it. And it's impossible not to miss the playoffs. The playoffs are a big deal. I know they don't seem like it on the outside of, you know, you're playing for a, let's say, Midwest League title. What does that really mean? But for these guys who, some of whom have been with that team since April, when you are told to be at the park every day to improve yourself and play for the team, and at the end of the road is a league title, that means something. That's a big deal. And some of these clubs that have been really well homegrown have done that because they've formed winning teams at the minor leagues. I think of the Kansas City Royals last decade. Yeah. They had a real base of prospects who all came up and were winning lots of, you know, division titles and league titles together as a group. So when they made the majors, they knew what that was. That was winning was not new to them collectively. It wasn't just slamming a bunch of players together and say, oh, you guys figured out you're all talented. They had done that as a group. The San Diego Padres last year, Double A Amarillo won a league title, and they've traded a lot of guys from that team. But at the same time, they were putting in the pieces in place for a winning culture. And now, you know, we're seeing some of that benefit now. They've done that at other levels as well. But for a guy like Mackenzie Gore, who's still in the organization, or Luis Patino, to go through that Amarillo team, win a league title, know what that feels like. The Padres are trying to build a World Series winner. To do that first in the Texas League and then maybe potentially bring that to the major leagues, that stuff does matter. So, yeah, it's the end of the road. And that's what I'm going to miss this year, is so many times we get the cliche quote from players of being like, what are you looking forward to the rest of the year? It's like, oh, well, we want a championship. We want the ring. And we just, part of us wants to roll our eyes and be like, okay, kid, like, we know you want to make the majors, whatever. You're trying to say the right thing. But this is their day job. This is their life for the summer. This is what they work towards all year round. So wherever you are, you want to win a league title. And that's, we get to crown so many league championships. That's the great thing about the minor leagues, is that it's so expansive and there's so many different league champions. And then in AAA, the IL winner goes up against the PCL winner in the AAA national championship. Almost feels like baseball, or at least minor league baseball's version of the Super Bowl. One game, that's all you get. Usually in a third location. Anyways, it's usually in a third location, so there's not really home field advantage. It's just a great way to celebrate minor league baseball. It gets put on national television. We don't get that this year either. So it's another thing we're kind of robbed of, but it is fun to look back on what the playoffs are, what they mean to these guys, and gives us another thing to look forward to 2021, because we're definitely not going to take these three-game series, five-game series here and there across all the various leagues for granted come this time next year.
That is certainly true. And final point of our open for this week's episode of the show. Today is Roberto Clemente Day across Major League Baseball, as the Pittsburgh Pirates will all don Clemente's number 21. Players of Puerto Rican descent, players born in Puerto Rico, are also, they have that option to wear number 21 today. And Roberto Clemente, a Hall of Famer as a ball player, and also one of the greatest humanitarians that baseball has ever seen. It's cool to see the sport, and the Pirates move for this has been out there in the public for a little while, that they would all wear 21 today. But it's neat that Major League Baseball is embracing this with Roberto Clemente's legacy.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I'll add my voice on top of that. I think 21 should be retired across baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know what type of player Roberto Clemente was. 3,000 hits obviously stands out. If you get a chance to see his arm from right field, it was incredible. A potential five-tool guy, really the standard for outfielders from his era. And knowing what we know of him about a humanitarian, and you know, the way he died trying to deliver goods, down to the Caribbean, and tragically dying in the plane crash. This is a guy who is a hero to so many people in this game, not just Puerto Rican players, but, you know, Latino players from all over, from anywhere in the Caribbean, from places in South America. And really, he should be the standard for any player, regardless of where you come from, to be that type of player on the field, like I said, 3,000 hits, and to be the type of humanitarian he was off of it, that's the type of standard we should all be uplifting. And you hear guys from Puerto Rico talk about him. I know Francisco Lindor, you know, went on and on about him just this week. And, you know, the Molina brothers are from Puerto Rico. Carlos Correa is from Puerto Rico. Javier Baez. There's a really strong influence, especially at the major league level right now, for Puerto Ricans. And knowing that they have almost this guy who's basically a baseball saint to look up to and set that standard is huge. You know, Jackie Robinson's 42 is one of those eternal numbers. I would love to see Roberto Clemente's numbers join that as well, just so we can give him a space and remember him every year. Let's not let this be a this year thing where it's only the Pirates and only Puerto Rican players. Let's all celebrate him together, make sure his number is retired. And so, you know, when kids of any stripe from anywhere go to a major league park and they look at the retired numbers and they see, you know, their local club's players, they see 42 and they ask about 21, who does that stand for? They ask their parents and their parents can give them that story. And that becomes Roberto Clemente becomes a hero to that kid as well. That's huge. And those are the stories we should be telling about our game. So excited for what's happening today, like you mentioned, with the Pirates and with Puerto Rican players. Would love to see that expanded in the future, but never a bad time to look back on Roberto Clemente's legacy and what he means to the game of baseball.
And a guy who was so proud of his heritage and who he was early on in his career, media members and largely, of course, white media members tried to call him Bobby Clemente. They tried to make that his name. And he stood up and said, no, my name is Roberto. My name is Roberto Clemente. And that's what I want to be called. And to be able to do that in that era and make sure that you're putting your stamp on your own legacy and not letting anyone write that for you is pretty incredible. And yeah, a guy who's, you know, like you said, trying to deliver goods to earthquake victims and is killed in a plane crash. He knew so much of his life was bigger than just baseball, and yet he was one of the greatest baseball players of all time and a pretty incredible man and a very neat day today for honoring him in Major League Baseball. And across the minor leagues, obviously there are a lot of teams that have done that as well. I know the Hartford Yardgoats have number 21 retired, but Roberto Clemente, a guy who, if you don't know a lot about him, pick up a book. There's a great biography about him, and you can find a lot today. And obviously you'll be hearing this later on in the week, but there'll be a lot out there about Roberto Clemente, and go do your own reading and research because he is a fascinating baseball life. And with that, we'll wrap up our intro on this week's episode of the Show Before the Show. A lot coming up today, and we'll try to get you up to speed on what life would have been like in the 2020 postseason and such, but we'll also look back at what some teams have done this year to try to capture the feel of a season in which there was no season. Benjamin Hill will join us later, and Josh Jackson will join us later as this week's episode continues on the Show Before the Show.
This past year has shown us that without your health, you have nothing. If you're not well, you can't work, look after yourself, or take care of your family. You can't enjoy the life you've worked so hard to build. That's why you need to prioritize taking care of your long-term health today, before it goes from good to bad to worse. So invest in your long-term health with Forward. Forward is intelligent medicine with a personal touch. Their doctors are dedicated to catching top killers like cancer and heart disease early before it's too late. And catching them early could save you tens of thousands of dollars in the long run. Everyone's health history is different, which is why Forward doctors personalize a health plan with you, based on your genetics, lifestyle, and biometrics to achieve long-term results and ensure nothing gets missed. It's time to invest in a doctor that's invested in you. Go to GoForward.com today to protect your future health. That's GoForward.com. GoForward.com.
Joining us on this week's Minor League Baseball podcast, the Show Before the Show, is AA Amarillo manager in the Padres system, Philip Wellman. Philip, thank you so much for joining the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for joining us. And a big reason we wanted to bring you on the show this week, actually two big reasons, but one of the biggest reasons is right now would be the start of the minor league postseason. We would be talking about previewing, you know, postseasons across the country, coast to coast, AAA all the way down to the rookie levels. You went through a postseason last year with AA Amarillo. You guys won a Texas League title in the first year of the Sod Poodles' existence. 1 year on from that,
What are your memories of that postseason run, and what did you take away from last year and that group?
Well, you know, it was great. It was an exciting time, and you know, it's kind of a fairy tale story. We moved from San Antonio into Amarillo, and you know, to get in the playoffs was outstanding. And you know, I don't know if you remember, but the first round against Midland, we were down zero games to two, and we won three in a row in Midland. And got to the championship round, and you know, it was a hard fought battle. We were down 3-1 going into the ninth inning in Tulsa, and came back and won that game. So it couldn't have played out any better. And you know, you're right. I thought on Labor Day, I said, well, this is would have been our last regular scheduled game. And one of two things would have been happening the day after Labor Day. We'd either been getting ready for the playoffs, or we'd have been packing up, getting ready to come home. But unfortunately, we've been home for the past 5 or 6 months.
Right. Yeah. And what is the importance of a postseason run like that? I mean, you know, for the casual baseball fan, they're all focused on the major leagues, and it's all about producing, you know, minor leaguers, turning them into major leaguers to make postseason runs there. But these playoffs exist for a reason, and it's to reward these guys for a hard summer of work. As a manager, what does a title run mean like that for you personally, and just for these players as they're getting their careers going?
Well, I think it means a lot more to the players. Not that it doesn't mean anything to the managers and coaches, but I think it's an instrumental part of the process of getting a guy ready to play in the big leagues. I think once you get to the playoffs, all your senses are heightened. There's a greater sense of urgency. All the things you preach about during the year kind of come to fruition. You know, every pitch matters, every at bat matters. I think it gives them valuable experience for what they're going to be faced with when they get to the big leagues. You know, I know, you know, the Padres made a plethora of trades here last week, and I looked at somebody put it on Twitter the other day, our game five lineup in Tulsa, six of the eight position players that were in the lineup have been traded. And, you know, I can't help but to think that, you know, their performance in the playoffs and just being in the playoffs gave them a little greater experience than just playing 140 games. And they have a little better idea of what to expect when they get to the big leagues.
Yeah, that was the second big thing I wanted to talk to you about. We might as well bring it up now since you brought it up there. You know, looking back at that lineup, Taylor Trammell, Edward Olivares, Owen Miller, Luis Torrens, Hudson Potts, Buddy Reed are all in separate organizations now. A big reason for that is the Padres are contenders because of their homegrown talent and what they've done the last couple of years. But another part of that, like you said, is other clubs wanting these players. How do you view that, knowing that so many guys you helped develop and coach last year have moved on?
You know, I think it exemplifies our scouting department, our pro scouting department. You know, some of those guys we got in trades, some of them were homegrown, but I think it bodes well for the player development staff, you know, all the way down to rookie ball, because a lot of those guys, you know, Andres Munoz and the likes started out with us in rookie ball and developed very nicely before they ever got to Double A, and hopefully we finished them off a little bit and helped them realize some things that they needed to do to be successful in the big leagues. And lo and behold, now, you know, I turn on and I see Josh Naylor in the big leagues and Edward Olivares and the Royals in the big leagues, Torrens and Ty France with the Mariners. And, you know, you can't help but to feel proud and feel good and feel happy for those kids. And hopefully, you know, we have a little bit of fingerprint on them that help them develop to be able to go be successful in the big leagues.
And what do you feel like that fingerprint is for the Padres right now? Obviously, having one of the best farm systems in baseball, even after all these trades, speaks to how good the player development pipeline has been the last couple of years. But what would you say is the Padres' stamp on prospect development?
You know, I think we stay with we had a Zoom managers meeting the other day, and I brought up the fact that I think that the fact that we're unified across the board in our player development system, and we have pretty specific player development plans for each of them. And every time a kid got promoted from A ball to double A, that's the first thing I would do is go to their, get on the computer, go to their player development plan. And we tried to stay, you know, consistent with what we were stressing and what we were teaching and what we're trying to develop from each and every one of those players. And you know, it paid off. And like I said, some of those guys that were traded have been around for 4 or 5 years. I think something that gets overlooked often in our player development, because we are there to develop players, but I think the fact that we put a pretty good product on the field at every level, and we're able not only to develop them, but we teach them how to win. And I've always thought that was very important. As long as they turn the scoreboard on every night, I think there's an objective. You have to trust the process, but without an objective, it's kind of useless. And the fact that these guys were able to get better and produce and win ball games all bodes well for the organization and for the player. So when his time is there to go play in the big leagues, he has an understanding of what he's there for.
Yeah, and specifically when it comes to managing in the playoffs, how do you marry those concepts? Because a lot of what the minor leagues is, as you mentioned there, is player development, getting these players ready for the major leagues, forming out their tools. But when you come to the postseason, it's win every day. And I know that's the case during the regular season too, but that's to a heightened level at the playoffs. How do you marry those as a coach, as a manager, and in your discussions with players going into must-win games like you guys had last year against Midland and Tulsa?
I don't think you change much of anything. You keep riding the horse that got you there, and you keep – I don't think I managed the playoff games any different than I did the regular season games. And you're never going to forsake the development of a prospect to try to win a ball game. There was at times some prospects, just like in the big leagues, guys that may have been struggling, but you know what, you give them the opportunity, you don't pinch hit for them. You give them the opportunity. And the prime example is Taylor Trammell. He didn't, after we got him from the trade, he didn't have a great month and a half. But he showed up every day. He worked his tail off. He was a great teammate. And he came up with no outs and the bases loaded and hit a grand slam to give us the lead in the game five of the championship series. But, I don't think you do anything much different. You trust the process with the objective in mind. And I think that grand slam someday we may look back and that might be the at bat that propelled Taylor Trammell to great things and got him over the hump.
Yeah. And going back to that grand slam, like you said, you guys were going into that inning down 3-1, he hits it, you guys win 8-3. How long does it take to come down from a win like that? I mean, especially in that fashion, when you guys score 7 runs in the ninth, it features a go-ahead grand slam. It has all these dramatics almost straight out of a movie. How long did that feeling last for you in the weeks afterwards?
You know what, when I think about it, even today, I still get, kind of excited. It was, as a manager, sometimes you look for the right things to say. And I remember them coming in off the field after the bottom of the eighth. And I was walking down the dugout to go out to coach third. And the only thing that came to mind to say to them is because they kind of had a blank look on their face because, they're 3 outs away from their season ending after having a great run. And I remember telling them, all I told them was just keep playing, Every at bat matters, keep playing. And then I thought, you know what? The reason I said that is because that's what I've been saying all year long. Whether we were up or down, hey, it all counts. Keep playing the game. And I guess I'm not smart enough to come up with any good Newt Rockne speeches before the ninth inning. But, lo and behold, a couple of walks, a great bunt for a hit, and then the bases are loaded. And then Taylor does it, and we kept going. That's what impressed me with him is that even though we took a 2-run lead, we kept playing, another walk, another hit, and then Hudson Potts, it's a 3-run bomb. And I knew our bullpen was in pretty good shape, and Travis Radke came in and went 1-2-3, and the celebration was on. But it was a great feeling, and it was like I said, it was almost fairy tale because I'll be honest, there were times you know, during that game where things weren't going real good. We weren't swinging the bats good. We were down 3-1. And I remember going out to coach third in the eighth thinking that, you know, I better come up with something to say to these kids if we lose, you know, because they put in a lot of effort and they've played their rear ends off. And then all of a sudden I thought to myself, why are you thinking that? Why are you even thinking about that? Just if it happens, if we end up losing, just speak from the heart and they'll appreciate that. But, you know, I was kind of thinking about what I needed to say if we lost. And you know, that to me was that little man on your shoulder talking nonsense. And I quickly aborted those thoughts and said, hey, we still got six outs. Let's go. And lo and behold, you know, they kept grinding out at bats. And, you know, we preach three things in the Padre organization: offensively, on base percentage, end zone contact, and out of zone chase rate. And, you know, all those things, you know, they came to fruition in the last inning. You know, we got guys on base. We didn't chase bad pitches. And when we got a pitch in the zone, we hit it good. And it was kind of a culmination of a season-long, you know, teaching session or player development session. It was something that, you know, a lot of the cliches you hear about as a kid growing up, you know, until you feel them like that inning right there, you often don't believe them. But I'm a firm believer now. The game's not over until that last out's made.
Yeah, and you mentioned Taylor Trammell in there, and let's go through some of these individual prospects that have been traded. You know, you mentioned a rough go of it from him last year after he got traded from the Reds in the middle of the season. He had 32 games with you guys during the regular season, had a 697 OPS. Obviously, a lot of people are still big fans of his, both for his work on the field and off the field. What impression did he make even when he was struggling, and what do you think led to some of those struggles for him down the stretch that he was able to correct in one at-bat, one big at-bat there in Game 5?
You know, in all honesty, he struggled when he first got there, and you know, I know he came over highly touted, and he knew that, and I think he pressed a little, and I remember calling him in one afternoon and talking to him again, saying, hey, just be yourself. Just go be yourself. You've hit before. You don't forget how to hit. Just go be yourself. And, you know, I don't know that he made any real adjustments per se mechanically or anything during the season, but the last 2 weeks of the season, the real Taylor Trammell started showing up. And, you know, he probably did most of his damage in the last 2 weeks, and then he was really good in the playoffs and in the 10 games we played in the playoffs. And, you know, he came back to big league camp this year, and I did notice some mechanical adjustments, and I looked at some video of him from when he was in A-ball, and he looked more like that. He was more upright and working down and through the ball, and you know, he swung the bat really good in big league camp. But, you know, I can't help but to think that grand slam gave him some freedom in his mind and in his thoughts. And he went home after the season and he went to work and cleaned some stuff up. And in spring training, I saw a different guy.
And the other guy you mentioned there who hit a home run, Hudson Potts, now a member of the Boston Red Sox organization, coming over in the Mitch Moreland trade. He spent pretty much all last year with you guys, 107 games, hit 16 homers. But was aggressively pushed, I would say. You know, he was there for his age 20 season. There were some reports that he struggled a little bit with velocity up and in, but again, you know, had a big moment there at the final game. What did you see from him, especially being such a young player thrown into the deep water of Double-A, and what development did you see from Hudson Potts in 2019?
Well, you know, he in 2018, he came up halfway through the season as a 19-year-old. And, you know, it's easy to say that, you know, if a guy struggles and he comes up early and he struggles, it's easy to say he was pushed. But, you know, I thought it was a great experience for him. He got his feet wet in 18, and then, you know, 19, there was some improvement in some regards. His defense was a lot better. He had a better idea. Even though his at-bats may not have always been productive, he had better at-bats. And, you know, I suspect if the Red Sox start him in Double-A again as a 21-year-old, you'll start seeing the real Hudson Potts, because he's got some tools that he can't teach.
What would those tools be, would you say?
One of them's power, obviously. And, you know, I think he has tremendous bat speed. I think the longer he'll play, you know, you said something about velocity up and in. You know, I don't think I've ever written a report in 35 years that says guy really handles velocity up and in well. You know, I don't think there's many guys. I don't think there's big league hitters that handle velocity up and in very well. And I think in due time he'll learn to lay off of that and not swing at it. And you know, because that was some of the things, his end zone contact rate wasn't where we want it to be, and he still chased a little too much. But I think as he grows and matures and has more experience, he'll quit swinging at some of those pitches and narrow his strike zone down, and you know, the real Hudson Potts will show up. But you know, it's like I said, it's easy to say, you know, that he was rushed, but I don't remember too many people saying that Fernando Tatis was rushed to Double A when he was 19. You know, it's if you have a good go at it, then you weren't rushed. You know, if you struggle a little bit, then people go, oh, he was rushed. But I think when it's all said and done, we look back, I think that year and a half of experience at a young age in Double A is going to pay dividends.
And moving on to somebody who was a little bit more age appropriate for you guys last year was Edward Olivares. 18 homers, 35 stolen bases, some really exciting offensive tools there. He gets moved to the Kansas City Royals this year. He had 13 games with the Padres getting called up, and that now he's been in 6 games with the Royals. Obviously put enough tools on the field to jump straight from Double-A to the majors. But what excited you most about Olivares, and what do you think he showed in that time with the Sod Pools to make both the Padres and Royals think he's ready for Major League Ball in 2020?
You know, I think his tools are very obvious, and I'll break those down in a minute. But I think just his baseball IQ and his instincts and understanding how to play the game, and that was impressive for me for his first year in Double A. And his ability to be consistent all year long was incredible. And you know, there were games where you'd look back after the game and you'd say, how did Edward Olivares help us win tonight? Well, some nights it was his defense. He'd run a ball down in the gap. Some nights as he'd throw to the right base and the next pitch would be a double play ball. Some nights it was he stole 35 bases. Some nights it was a big steal when we were tied in the eighth or something. He could beat you in with his tools every way possible. It wasn't just about his bat and it wasn't just about his power, but he could run. He could steal bases. He was a great base runner. He played a great right. He played right and center both, but He did, you know, his arm could beat you. And, you know, just him knowing where to throw the ball and him knowing where to position himself and reading hitters, I thought that was great. You know, he's like a lot of young kids that you get excited about. You might get him once on a pitch, but once he saw it once, you weren't going to get him again. And I thought that was a one of his best abilities he had at the plate was – you know, he might chase a bad slider, but if you throw that same slider to him again, he took it. And, you know, very mature for his age. But, you know, I really enjoyed watching him play because he had joy in his heart when he played. And, you know, it was just to see him go from I'll tell you how smart I am. I started him out in the 7 hole. And, you know, just because he was young and it was his first year in Double-A and he wanted to get his feet wet, but after about 2 weeks in the 7 hole, he went in the 3 hole and he stayed there the rest of the year. And it was truly an honor and a pleasure to get to watch him play every day.
And the last guy I want to touch on here that has been traded away, he's moved on, is Owen Miller, part of the massive Mike Clevenger deal between the Padres and the Indians. Played 130 games for you guys last year. Seemed like he was one of your most consistent performers from beginning to end. Another guy kind of pushed aggressively. That was his first full season. Coming out of Illinois State, but hit the ground running pretty well. I know you guys played him at a couple different infield positions, but what stood out to you about Owen Miller and, you know, what can Cleveland fans kind of expect out of him now that he's part of that organization?
You know, he can hit, and that's the first thing that comes to mind. I've never seen a guy, I wish I knew the number, but I don't know how many multi-hit games he had during the year, but I mean, it just seemed like every night he was destined to get 2 or 3 hits. And he seemed like, you know, he was always right in the middle of stuff. And I can remember nights where we were behind and he was coming up fifth. And I'd tell our hitting coach, you know, we got to get to Owen Miller. If we can get to Owen Miller in this inning, we'll have a chance. And, you know, that's just the kind of guy he was. And you know, for his first full season in Double A, you know, it was very impressive. You know, he's got some, he's got to work on his defense. And, but, you know, again, for his first full year, he did okay defensively, but I think there's room to grow there defensively. And I'm not real sure whether, you know, he's going to end up at second or end up at short or third. I don't know, but I know if he keeps swinging the bat the way he's capable of swinging the bat, the Indians are going to find somewhere to play this kid.
And we've touched on a lot of guys individually here, but just to go back to the collective, when there were so many eyes on this Amarillo team down the stretch and you have so many interesting prospects and now they're all, you know, kind of spread to the wind like this, how much do you feel like they leaned on each other and got different tool sets or different advice or, you know, picked each other up during the season and helped their individual statuses or profiles because of how they did as a collective?
You know, I think it was huge. I think I think competition, even amongst each other, is a great thing. And I think they pushed each other. And you know, I looked one time at the roster, and we had guys representing 9 different countries on that ball club. And I always found that to be, you know, especially with what's going on today. I said, you know, this different cultures, different backgrounds, different religions, different countries, they come and they all get along. It was amazing. You know, it might've been, you know, I had one clubhouse meeting all year, you know, and at times I felt like my job was just to make sure they showed up on time and make sure we had enough baseballs on the field, you know, for them to get their work in. And it was a great collection of guys you know, they helped each other, and we had Venezuelans, Dominicans, Cubans, Canadians, Americans, Colombians. They just got along. And I think the one thing that they had a common goal, and I think they all knew they were close, and they all knew that they had a chance of playing in the big leagues, and they understood, you know, one of the things I preach, you know, from the get-go, just be a good teammate, pick each other up. You know, a guy makes an error, you got to make a pitch, pick him up. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times between innings I'd see Yvonne Castillo, if he made an error, you know, the pitcher would make a great pitch, and between innings he'd go, hey, man, appreciate it, you know. And that's, in essence, that's their job. And, you know, the pitching staff, the position players, the offense picked up. I mean, we had a rough inning pitching. They picked each other up. But I think just the competition within the clubhouse is always good. And I think they didn't back down from it. And, you know, Yvon Castillo led the league in hitting, but, you know, Eddie Olivares, he wasn't going to let Yvon get too far ahead of him. And, you know, they just pushed each other, and in turn, they got better.
All right, Phil, we'll leave you on this one. My colleague, Katie Wu, did a story back in July that I don't want to spoil too much. I want people to go seek it out. But it was about how managing is kind of becoming a family business for you and the way your son, Brett, has been coaching the Sod Squad there in Amarillo as part of the Texas Collegiate League. We normally have prospects on the show and players, but I wanted to get your perspective from this as well. You know, for minor league managers, for people trying to make it in that profession, minor league coaches, what kind of advice do you give them, starting with your son, Brett, here, and to others who are trying to make it in that way and trying to do so much of what we talked about here today, develop players, win on the field, and get these guys turned into major leaguers?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what I told my son. I said, you know, first and foremost, if you don't have a true, sincere passion for the game, you're wasting your time. Because in the minor leagues, the monetary reward's not—that's not the answer. And I said, you got to have a heart of a servant. And I said, Brett, I know he's going to get married in November, but obviously don't have any kids yet. But I said, you just remember that every one of those kids that you're talking to—that's somebody's pride and joy. That's somebody's son. That's somebody's jewel. Don't ever forget that. And you treat them the same way. You know, my son was lucky enough to play 4 years and with the Blue Jays. And I said, just remember, you know, that's somebody's son, and you treat them the same way that you would want to be treated. I said, that doesn't mean, you know, you can't discipline them. It doesn't mean you can't push them, and doesn't mean you can't challenge them. But I said, you know, don't forget when they're struggling. We've all struggled in this game, and you don't forget what that feels like. And, and what you need. Sometimes you just need someone to talk to. But I said, you know, at to be real honest with you, at my level, and I think it's probably true in the big leagues and in Texas Collegiate League, you're managing people more than the game, because a guy across the dugout from you, he probably knows just as much about X's and O's as you do. And so the separator is how you treat your players and how you get them to bust their tail every day and come to work and put in a blue collar work day and make it fun, make it enthusiastic, make it a positive atmosphere. And I think my son picked up some stuff along the way, you know, just being in the dugout and playing pro ball. And he had a good run in the summer and managed a team with the best record and got named manager of the year. Good for him. And hopefully that parlays into a job, because I know where his passion lies. And, you know, I've told him things are going to be a little different this year with all the changes. So it might be tough, you know, getting a managing job in the minor leagues, but, you know, stay with it and keep sending your resume out and keep calling people. And someday somebody's going to give you a chance and then be grateful for the chance and cherish the opportunity and go make the most of it.
Definitely. Well, we look forward to hopefully seeing him in a dugout again sometime soon, seeing you in a dugout sometime soon, and potentially, maybe even repeating in a weird way a Texas League title in 2021 when we get back on the field. But, Phil, thank you so much for joining us this week. This has been really great. And all the best down there in Chattanooga.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for having me.
It is hard to believe that we would be talking about the final weekend of the regular season with Benjamin Hill, and in an alternate universe, maybe we're doing that somewhere. Ben led off a story this week that said, quote, "Ready to have your mind blown? If the 2020 minor league baseball season had happened, it would have already happened," meaning that the final day of the regular season would have been this week on Labor Day, which is insane. And we welcome Ben in for this week's conversation. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Tyler, and hey, Sam. And it is true that in an alternate reality, we were talking about things that happened in the world of minor league baseball over the season concluding Labor Day weekend. I believe I was on the road somewhere, perhaps Fredericksburg. I'm getting a faint transmission of the alternate us in the conversation we're having. And I'm trying to tune that out so I can focus on this dimension's conversation. It's kind of difficult. But yes, there was no season in 2020. But if there had been, it'd be over. I just can't make sense of things anymore.
Well, it's a great story that is up on the site that it's titled Hindsight 2020. And you look back on kind of what would have been in the 2020 season. I know we talked about that a lot this year, but also discussing a lot of things that did happen as teams, you know, kind of tried to flex their creative muscle in the most challenging season in minor league memory, whether it was doing streams of games on MLB The Show or opening ballparks up to fans for movies or fireworks or whatever it is. Take us through this rundown of kind of what did happen in a season in which there was no season.
Yeah, exactly. The premise of this article is that there wasn't a season, but we still had a season, and that minor league teams didn't completely shut down entirely, or at least most of them didn't. They, you know, still tried to generate revenue, still tried to be active in the community in some way, shape, or form. So this article is a roughly chronological run through of the things we saw this year and the things that comprised the season as it was. So like you mentioned, MLB The Show video, you know, streamed live via Twitch, and even some teams aired their MLB The Show games on like local television. If you can remember back that far into April, I mean, Binghamton Rumble Ponies did that. Then talking about, you know, the emergence of masks as a new piece of team merchandise that everyone was selling, parking lot fire shows, parking lot fireworks shows, there we go, that the Omaha Storm Chasers did first, and then we started to see those around minor league baseball. Daytona Tortugas did the first movie night, and then there were some teams that due to their state or county regulations couldn't allow people onto the field, so there were some teams like Rocky Mountain Vibes who did drive-in movie nights, if you recall that, with, you know, cars literally driving onto the outfield. Of course, a roundup of curbside concessions. Then, you know, special standout things like, of course, Pensacola Blue Wahoos becoming a Airbnb at the ballpark, $1,500 a night Airbnb rental at the ballpark. That went viral. That got a lot of recognition, and so on and so forth. The whole spate of undefeated T-shirts once the season was officially canceled, with teams declaring themselves undefeated, and then, of course, the more snarky iteration of those shirts where teams, you know, kind of took a more skeptical view of 2020, like the Durham Bulls, you know, this is bull shirt and things of that nature. And those shirts continue to come out. Just Visalia, just earlier this week, released a shirt, the Visalia Rawhide, that says 2020, and then straight cow, and then a poop emoji, so, or a bull, really. So straight bull poop kind of thing. Anyway, you can think about it. And if you want to get a shirt that has a bull and a poop emoji made by a minor league baseball team, check out the Visalia Rawhide, and so on and so forth. So teams, you know, kept doing things and keep doing things. And obviously there's not a hard and fast line between the offseason and the season as there is in most years. So a lot of things I wrote about in the story will continue in some way, shape, or form through the offseason. And then everyone has his fingers crossed for as normal as possible 2021, although it'll certainly be its own adventure for many reasons, 2021, but just looking forward to that and looking forward to hopefully a full 140-game minor league baseball season.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to ask about too, Ben, is so much of this story is probably hopefully going to stay in 2020. Those shirts you're talking about, the idea of you know, needing to sell certain types of merchandise and certain types of food as takeout options. But do you feel like any of this could carry forward into the 2021 season? Not necessarily like fireworks shows in the parking lots, because hopefully we'll have fans in the stands next year. But what of these other things? Are we going to see like Airbnbs during road trips? What do you think about some of the ideas that came out of this year could carry forward to next year?
Yeah, I think absolutely. There are some things we'll look back on, you know, in this article, in the 2020 season as a whole, that we'll look back on as very much products of 2020. But I think a lot of things is teams, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, but now that teams through necessity invented these things, they might, you know, say like, oh, this is something we can incorporate in a quote unquote normal season. And I think, you know, to that end, more, you know, movie nights on the field for sure. I think a lot of teams were woken up to the fact a little bit that their food and beverage operation doesn't have to be just for 70 home games and events at the ballpark, that you could be in some cases a, you know, delivery service or a place that fans could go, just like a restaurant with regular hours, that kind of thing. You know, just food and beverage is a revenue source year round. You know, food at the ballpark to go, I think, is something that will last beyond that. Even maybe, you know, some cardboard cutouts, you know, teams that have, you know, big oversized ballparks, find a way to get some cardboard cutouts in there. You know, maybe some Florida State League teams that play in spring training complexes. You know, once the Florida State League season starts, they could put some cardboard cutouts in the far reaches of the stadium or that kind of thing. Who knows? I'm just riffing. But I do think a lot of the, wow, 2020's crazy stuff that we started to see during this season, as it was, will be things that carry on in 2021 as teams try to do everything they can to generate revenue and, you know, squeeze as much as they can out of the fans' entertainment dollar.
Ben, you are also working currently on a story in Kentucky. Well, you're not in Kentucky, but the story's in Kentucky, about the Battle of the Bourbon Trail. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote about Lansing Lugnuts Lemonade League, which is a two-team in-house collegiate circuit that the Lansing Lugnuts set up. Similarly and more ambitiously, the Bourbon Trail, the Battle of the Bourbon Trail League, is something that is still going on right now in Kentucky between, it's a partnership between the Lexington Legends, obviously a minor league baseball team, Class A South Atlantic League, and the Florence Y'all, previously the Florence Freedom, who are an independent team in the Frontier League. So this is a really unique partnership, and that these two Kentucky professional baseball entities both constructed two full teams of players. Lexington has two teams and Florence has two teams. And some configuration of those four teams play every single day at both locations between Wednesday and Sunday, five games a week in each location, Florence and Lexington. And it's this really eclectic, sprawling mix of local players, you know, collegiate players, former collegiate players. And as it's grown and word of mouth has grown around the players, you've gotten some big names. You have some former major leaguers, most impressively, right now, a member of the Battle of the Bourbon Trail version of the Lexington Legends is Brandon Phillips, who is tearing things up at the plate, currently batting 386, according to my notes, with a 426 on base percentage. He's had some walk-off home runs. His brother, I forget his brother's name, manages one of the teams in the league. Other members who are playing in Lexington right now, Robbie Ross Jr., Ben Revere, Both guys who went to high school in Lexington, so they had connections, and now they're playing in this improvised four-team league taking place between Florence and Lexington. And so it's, again, talking about 2020 and necessity is the mother of invention. This is a really unique one, a partnership like this, and something that it does seem hard to imagine this existing outside of the context of 2020, but it's pretty cool. Four teams still in operation, and there's going to be a playoff series, I think, coming up next week.
And Ben, before we let you go, we talked about this earlier in the show, Tyler and I, but we just wanted to get your reaction here with the news that MILB president and CEO Pat O'Connor is retiring come December 31st. You've worked for the site for a long time. Pretty much the entire time has been Pat O'Connor's tenure. Just what was your reaction to that news that came down earlier this week?
Well, you know, I think like a lot of things, it'll be easier to assess Pat O'Connor and his legacy once the dust has settled, because obviously right now his, his retirement announcement comes at a time when, you know, minor league baseball future, there's a lot to be determined with the number of teams and the specific relationship between major and minor league baseball. And, Pat O'Connor is right now very tied in with that. But I think as time passes, you know, I will say on a personal level, you know, I've crossed paths with Pat many times through the years. You know, he's an active ballpark traveler in his own right. And, he was always very friendly to me and supportive of what I did. And he has had almost 4-decade career in minor league baseball, almost 3 decades in the St. Petersburg office. And, you think about that kind of longevity as a president and before that, high ranking executive for minor league baseball, you know, he's overseen a lot of change in the industry and a lot of growth and I think quite a lot of good. So it's tough to assess right now because there's so much that's unknown. But I think when we look at, you know, Pat O'Connor having been, I think he was president since, I want to say 2007. And again, in the league office, in the minor league baseball league office, long before that, he's had a lot of influence on the game in ways that, once the dust settles, I think we'll look back on and be able to assess that legacy further. But no doubt he's a baseball lifer and put in a lot of time to this game.
Benjamin Hill, you can find on Twitter at Ben's Biz, and the stuff is up on the site right now. And thanks, man. It's weird to be talking the last week of the regular season, not have a last week of the regular season to talk about, but obviously a lot coming up for us, and we'll continue our conversations about the business and where we're headed through the end of the month. Not our conversations through the end of the month, those will continue long beyond that, but a lot coming up the next few weeks, and we'll discuss it all with you as it comes.
Yeah, we'll do our best. Always good talking to you guys. And, yeah, happy end of the season that wasn't. I feel like, I don't know, we should have all gotten together on Zoom and had a toast to the season.
There's still time.
Yeah, I guess.
We can do that on the date of the AAA National Championship game.
I was just going to say that, Tyler. That's a good idea.
Let's do it. And if you're listening, anyone who's listening to this podcast, AAA National Championship, what could have been celebration. Details TBD, or maybe they'll never be determined. But let's do something.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Dave.
Getting a chance to catch up with Josh Jackson on our minor league writer spotlight this week. I feel like it's been forever since we've talked with Josh. Hi, Josh.
Howdy. Howdy, everybody. How's it going?
It's good to talk to you, man. This is the story that we will discuss today is the first in a series, although I know we have been kind of covering stories like this, obviously, for quite some time, but now known as the Monsters of the Minors, presented by Uncle Ray's. And this story today that you've got is about a PCL star in the 1920s and 30s. And the name of the gentleman who you write about is as good as the story itself, Smead Jolly. And he was a beast in the PCL. Tell us a little bit about Smead Jolly. We'll dive into the story with you.
He was indeed a beast in the PCL. And
a monster of the minors, if you will.
He was a monster of the minors. And, you know, he's a character, you know, I think some baseball fans who have like a certain level of familiarity with either baseball history or just like old timey baseball anecdotes will already know Smead Jolly's name, but not as a person who won 6 batting titles in the minor leagues and 2 home run crowns and once a triple crown in the Pacific Coast League, but as a sort of oafish and clown type figure in the major leagues, which is just really unfortunate that's sort of the reputation he has. So hopefully with this story and this podcast segment right here, right now, we can sort of disabuse you of that being the primary image you have of Smead Jolly, if you have one at all. And if you don't have one, I hope I didn't just implant that one first. Because let's focus again on the fact that he just raked absolutely basically everywhere. He, even in the majors, he was a very good hitter. He hit 305 with 178 extra base hits and 473 major league games. So it's not like he was, you know, great. We're not talking about a guy who is somebody we would call like a 4A hitter today. This is a guy who just was one of the great hitters of his time. And, you know, that's not me saying that. I'm talking about, you know, I never saw him hit. I'm talking about people like Bobby Doerr and Luke Appling was tremendously impressed by his hitting. These are people who saw him hit, played with him, and knew that this guy was just an absolute, cracker jack in the box, to coin a term,
A fitting term for a player of his era. He was an Arkansas-born slugger. He ends up in the PCL, and this is obviously a different time. We've discussed this on the show in the past, but the Pacific Coast League in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and on was essentially a third major league. It was a much different era of baseball in which there were not direct affiliations in a lot of cases between major league teams and minor league teams or minor leagues as such. So he ends up out there, and it kind of turns himself into this Bunyan-esque character of, you know, winning a triple crown and hitting over 400 and all that. What was his, as he started to gain that notoriety, I know the defensive, I don't want to say prowess because it sounds like that was not necessarily a calling card, but that was something that stuck with him. How was he viewed by his contemporaries around the game of baseball? Because like you said, when he got to the major leagues, there were a lot of guys who said, oh no, he could really hit. It seems like he was just kind of one of those guys that fellow players recognized how special his talent was.
Absolutely. And I think fans did too. Tyler, I remember slacking with you like a while back when I was starting this story, and I found like some old message board from the earlier days of the internet, and there was like a 96-year-old man.
Oh yeah.
He was, you remember this guy, so he went out to, he remembered Smead Jolly from going to San Francisco Seals games when he was a kid, and just, he said, you know, this is the greatest hitter who's ever played baseball. Now, I'm not telling you that, you know, that man is sort of empirically right, and that, but, you know, that's the impression that he could make on players and fans for sure. And, you know, you alluded to his size, and I guess I should too, that he was a very big man. He was 6'3", which, you know, is a little taller than Roof. And
especially at the time, the 1920s, 6'3" is like a 7-footer now.
Exactly. And, you know, his weight was about, over his career, you know, it varied. I know how that goes. My weight has varied tremendously over my career, but he, you know, reportedly up to like, I saw one newspaper from toward the end of his career list him at 240 pounds from about 210 when he started. So he was a huge man. So the question you asked me was about how other players saw him. And you also mentioned, you know, the defensive, not lack of prowess. I'm not trying to make the case here on the pod or in this story that he was a good defender. Although he certainly, you know, there are quotes I came across that are not in the story that, and some that are, I think, that allude to his impression of himself as a fielder, which he thought he was probably about average, but it's that thing of, first of all, well, he felt like you could, at the time, there was like a binary kind of thinking in fans. They thought of you as a good hitter, or they thought of you as a good fielder. And in most cases, he felt like, you know, they thought of you as a great hitter. They thought of you as a terrible fielder. In reality, he was probably pretty bad. But it's also that thing of like, you know, if you know that your friend thinks you're a bad driver, then every time you like hesitate weird at a stop sign, or like every time you do anything that's like anything really, you can find something to sort of confirm that view of you, that label that they've stuck on you. I think that probably happened with him. He was definitely, you know, not maybe the fastest guy, not the most graceful. There's an anecdote, you know, that's the most famous one about him that is in the story, so I won't go into it too much, but there's one, a story that he allegedly made 3 errors on the same play one time as an outfielder, which, you know, that's hard to do. That's probably fictitious. There's another story that's not in the story on MILB.com that I think I heard this one in Luke Appling's Hall of Fame. He gave oral history to the Hall of Fame and talked about who he called Smeedy Boy. And his story about Smeedy Boy was that he, you know, they were with the White Sox and they came to Fenway and there used to be like he called it a bump, like a raised area in the somewhere near the monster, not so close that it was like a warning track, but out in left field there was like a pitch that you'd have to climb. And he tells the story of Smead Jolly playing out there, and before the game he's working and working and working to like master going back on the hill, master charging up it, master, you know, dealing with this little raised piece of land every way he can. And then during the game, he has to charge forward on it, and he goes charging forward and he, you know, falls right on his face. And he comes into the dugout when the inning's over and he says, "They taught me how to go up that hump, but they forgot to tell me how to come back down it." So, yeah, you get the impression that certainly there was a degree of klutziness there that was real. But, like, you know, you look at his hitting and you think, this is a guy who, first of all, if you were playing in a designated hitter era, he'd probably be in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, but he is in the Pacific Coast League Hall of Fame for how good a hitter he was for so long. He had a 20-year professional career, a big portion of that in the Pacific Coast League.
That's one of the amazing things about that era, that guys could play 20 plus years in the minor leagues. That just that's not a thing that's happened for a long, long time.
Right. In some cases you could make, you know, for some players, we're not talking about like, you know, the Ruths of the era, but you might make more money in the Pacific Coast League than you would from a major league team. That's not the norm, but just the fact that it was possible that it could happen sort of tells you a lot about the era and sort of the idea of what the Pacific Coast League was. Again, we say this every time, but St. Louis was the farthest west that Major League Baseball got at that time.
Yeah, and that kind of brings up something I wanted to ask about, Josh, which was, you know, looking at his baseball reference page, this is a guy who drove in 100 runs in the majors in both 1930 and 1932. He finished in the top 25 in AL MVP voting in 32 when he split the season between the Chicago White Sox and Boston Red Sox. Do you think it was just these issues of, like, these tall tales of his defense, like, that actually hurt him? I mean, at the time, obviously, there wasn't TV. All you had were scouting reports, and if on the scouting report was that this is a guy who can't handle hills or makes 3 errors in a game, that's going to hurt him. Or do you feel like the reason why he didn't last as long in the majors was because of what you're saying, in that it was in some ways just as good to go and dominate the PCL for decades? Why do you think his major league career was this short?
You know, I think that he definitely felt like it was the reputation was hampering him. And there were you know, there was talk at the time that, like, well, to make up for how bad of a defender he is, which, you know, there, again, I'm not saying there's no truth to that idea that he was a terrible defender, but certainly, however bad he was, the reputation was much worse and much bigger. I really think, you know, that probably was the main thing. I think if he, you know, if, again, we're also, like, it's not like he had an agent who was out there kind of shopping him around to every team. Also, there were many fewer major league teams, and many more minor league teams. But, you know, there was a view that he would have had to hit even, you know, way better than he did to make up for his defensive deficiencies. They, you know, the White Sox tried him at catcher. They tried to convert him into a catcher. I think even the Red Sox, like, stuck him back there sometimes. And even that, I think that the idea was kind of like, oh, we'll stick him back here, and how bad can it be? Like, how much can he screw up just, like, not letting a ball go by him, especially considering that he's, as a newspaper account at the time described him, two sizes bigger than City Hall. but, you know, yeah, I mean, he had a strong arm, that's for sure. He led the American League in assists in 1930. So I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit of a mystery. But I think, yeah, it's probably a combination of both things, that there were legitimately good opportunities to play minor league baseball where, you know, he could be sort of the big deal that he was. And that there was this idea around the majors that he wasn't really worth, he wasn't going to be a star, right? And so certainly nobody was going to, like, pay him like a star. I didn't come across anything where, you know, a team was offering to sign him for blah blah money and he turned it down and said, no, I'm going to the Pacific Coast League. He didn't leave the Red Sox of his own accord and return to the PCL of his own accord. That wasn't his decision. But definitely there were reports and, like, you know, his most incredible season in the PCL of many incredible seasons of the PCL was 1928, and he was still with the Seals for 1929 because the asking price was so high on him. So that was a factor at that point. But then after after the White Sox bought him from the Seals in 1930, and, you know, major league team saw what he was and how he could hit, and, you know, the idea of him as a fielder kind of spread. He wasn't there a long time. He played four major league seasons.
It is a great story that is up on the site at MILB.com right now. These stories from Josh are always worth the read. They're especially worth the read because of the quotes that athletes were purported to have given to media members in the 1920s and 30s, and also just the way that sports writers wrote back then, because they are tremendously entertaining. So you should go read the story for those, and because it's a great story. Josh Jackson, you can find on Twitter at Josh Jackson MILB. And thanks, buddy. Great start to this Monsters of the Miners presented by Uncle Ray's. Nice work.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on, and thank you all for listening out there in Radio Land.
Final segment on this week's episode of the show before the show. Before we go, Sam has this week's Nationwide Prospect Fun Fact.
Yeah, so I know a lot of you have been following the Miami Marlins this year, and their kind of surprising run toward a potential playoff bid. It's been really exciting to watch Miami do that, relying a lot on young prospects. They brought up Jesus Sanchez at times this year. They recently brought up Jazz Chisholm. They've used Monte Harrison. But the best rookie they have, at least in terms of tools and even performance, I would say, is Sixto Sanchez. And one of the things that has made Sixto Sanchez's transition to the majors so good has been his elite fastball. So I'm going to give a hat tip here to Joe Frisaro of MLB.com. He tweeted out something similar to this, and I updated the numbers a little bit. But there have been 8 major league starters this year to hit at least 100 miles an hour on the radar gun. That's not rounding up, so that's 100 miles an hour and above. Sixto Sanchez has done it 10 times this year. Only Jacob deGrom, who has done it 14 times, has done it more. So Sixto Sanchez coming right up, showing elite major league velocity right now, already throwing 10 pitches at 100 miles an hour or higher. What the interesting thing to me is, beyond that, if we take this fun fact to another level, Sixto Sanchez actually has the highest percentage of 100 mile an hour pitches in Major League Baseball this year among starters. This is just among starters. He's hit triple digits on the gun 3.1% of the time. Doesn't sound like that much overall, but again, Jacob deGrom, who's done it 14 times, his percentage is 1.8. So Sixto's throwing it almost twice as often as deGrom. This is usually the type of velocity we think of with like an Aroldis Chapman or some of these really hard throwing relievers in the lower levels. But Sixto Sanchez already doing this is really promising, not only for him in his present state, you know, somebody who only pitched at AA last year, has not yet reached the AAA level, but immediately got bumped to the majors. And if he can keep doing this over the next couple of weeks, he could be the ace of that Miami staff if they make a playoff run, which would be really, really exciting. So who would have thought that a year ago? Who would have thought that 2 months ago when it looked like the Marlins were prepared to potentially punt even on a 60-game season, but they're very much contenders now. Sixto Sanchez becoming the ace of that club, really exciting. And again, it comes down to that 80-grade fastball of his.
He has been really fun to watch, and it's hard to believe that we're inside of 3 weeks until that playoff field is really solved and settled. And yeah, the Miami Marlins, who would have thought, but very much a contender in 2020. And that'll do it for this week's episode of The Show Before the Show. For Sam, I'm Tyler. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.